Little Bob here. This summer, shop the latest small space solutions at Bob's Discount Furniture. From retro chic bedroom sets to stylish space-conscious Bob-o-pedic sofas, it's all at Bob's, where America shops for furniture.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Cole.
And you're listening to Borrowed Bones, a podcast about fucked up, interesting, and toxic families.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into today,
yes,
I just wanted to remind everyone to please follow, comment on Apple, Spotify, rate, review. It really, really helps us out.
Mm-hmm.
So just do a little star, follow, say you're great or you suck. Whatever, it all helps. So
yeah.
Just whatever you can do, that would be wonderful. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Borrowed Bones Podcast. We also have a Divine account. That's also Borrowed Bones Podcast. It is a new Vine app.
Oh,
so okay. It's just like Vine back in the day, but it's called Divine now.
Oh,
and it's fun. It's all right. Really, it's a lot of fun. So yeah, follow us on that.
Okay.
But that's it for my little housekeeping.
All right. What are we talking about today?
Today, we have to kind of put our tinfoil hats on a little bit.
Okay.
It's kind of conspiracy, but I believe it.
Okay.
And there's a lot of fact around it. It's not like pure conspiracy.
Okay.
So we are talking about the three major families that basically shaped the American economic system.
So they're villains.
The reason we have the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
Yes. The big three banking families.
Oh, a bunch of capitalists.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Morgans, the Rockefellers, and the Rothschilds.
Oh. We'd be Rothchildren in the plural? I'm joking.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be.
I know.
Just, yeah.
I know. But yes, we are talking about how these families really made it to where we are slaves to the banks now.
Okay.
Now, all of this came to be on Jekyll Island.
Okay.
Of Georgia.
Oh, okay.
In the United States.
Yeah, not Georgia, the Asian country.
Yes. So let me tell you a little bit about Jekyll Island to set the scene before we get into it.
Okay. Is it spelled the same like Jekyll and Hyde?
J-E-K-Y-L-L.
Yep.
I did not look into the connection there because this was a lot for me to wrap my mind around. I was like, I don't even care. So if you want to look it up and comment on Apple or Spotify and let us know, Jekyll Island is named, or Jekyll and Hyde, if they're connected at all. But yes. So Jekyll Island began as a hunting and fishing destination for Native Americans in the area.
Okay.
Then the British colonists came, established forts, claiming land for England. Classic.
Did what they did.
Yep. The founder of Georgia named the island after Sir Joseph Jekyll.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then, yeah.
It's after a person, but I don't know if Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, I don't know where Robert Louis Stevenson got the name Jekyll for his character.
Not sure. So Sir Joseph Jekyll is who the island is named after, and he is a financial banker for the colony.
Mm.
Which is crazy that right from the get-go, this island is connected to finance.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. On the backs of the indentured servants they brought with them, Jekyll Island was built into a prosperous plantation.
Mm-hmm. Indentured servants. It's a polite euphemism.
Very polite. This came from, I'm going to link it because I used it, I'm going to link it in the show notes, a current Georgia website, I forgot the name of it, but I have it, that's promoting Jekyll Island as a modern day like
tourist
destination
attraction.
Spot.
Okay.
Yes. So they didn't mention indentured servants or anything. I found that elsewhere, of course, but they.
Well, it was Georgia.
Nice
so.
Picture. Yeah. After the Civil War in 1886, the island was purchased by the Jekyll Island Club. Now, this was a self-made club. It was made up of a group of men that included J.P. Morgan, Joseph Pulitzer, William K. Vanderbilt, Marshall Field and William Rockefeller.
Mm.
So they together bought the island in 1886. Okay. And it became the Jekyll Island Club on Jekyll Island.
All right.
A very high vacation destination hunting spot. Yeah. In 1904, Munsey's magazine called the Jekyll Island Club the richest, the most exclusive, the most inaccessible club in the world.
Oh. It's a glorified circle jerk for rich guys. That's probably literally what it is.
Yeah.
It's like Bohemian Grove in California. It's the exact same kind of thing where all these rich Republican muckety mucks go every year for a 2-week close quarters soiree. No girls allowed. It's like, all right. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's very much like that.
Yeah.
Jekyll Island was eventually sold to the state of Georgia in 1947. Like I said.
Probably for a mint.
To this. Yeah. I don't know how much. But to this day, the state of Georgia still owns it. It's public. Okay, it's a destination spot for tourists who want to see the mansion-sized cottages that the members built.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chapel that you can go visit. Apparently, that was a big deal. Mm. And a plantation to look at as well.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's where they sacrifice the virgins, probably, to the demon god something. Yes.
Yeah. And in this website, it never mentions the meeting on Jekyll Island. It just mentions how the highbrow went there and like the elites went there. So it's super famous. It's super grand. So the tourists, I doubt, that go there know the lasting effects of this super secret meeting held on Jekyll Island. From this meeting, the Federal Reserve was born. And because of that, the Great Depression was worse than it needed to be.
Okay.
We're not blaming this meeting and the group of men on, like, we're not blaming them for the Great Depression, but there's some economists out there that are like, they could have helped and they chose to let it go.
Every rich person could help and chooses not to.
Yep. So now we have the background.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get into it now.
Okay.
It's going to be nitty gritty. It's a little history heavy, but we need to know all of this background in order to understand why this super secret meeting that happened in 1910 matters so much.
All right.
I found this documentary on YouTube, and it's just called Jekyll Island.
Okay.
What?
I was just going to make a joke like, oh, it's on YouTube. So.
Well, it wasn't originally.
Okay.
It was originally like on TV or something. It has an air. It's
a real.
It's solid. Yeah. It's not like current. It's like from 16 years ago or something. And it gives that vibe of like 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The narrator is fantastic. And the channel on YouTube is called The Still Report. If you want to look at it, I do link it in the show notes as well. So you can find it. So this narrator is great, so I'm going to play a clip with him, and this is how he introduces Jekyll Island.
This film is about the greatest ripoff in history, the very way money and debt are created and controlled. This affects everyone on the planet and is the basic cause of all of our economic problems today. It is the cause of most of the world's hunger, poverty, misery, and disease. Until we all recognize this, in every nation, there is nothing any national government can do to fix the problem, and all of us will see nothing but mounting debts and sinking standards of living. Our children will inherit this mess, and it will only get worse every single year.
What's the title of the documentary?
Jekyll Island.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's on the channel The Still Report.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So that's his introduction to Jekyll Island and what happened on that day or that week that they had the meetings. So yes.
It's a strong opening statement.
Yeah. In order to really, really understand the impact of this meeting in Jekyll Island in 1910, we do need a bit of background on banks and how these three families got into this position where they held so much power.
It's a profession of getting rich while not sweating.
Yeah.
Banking.
So we're going to start with the Rothschilds. They are the oldest of the big three banking families and most likely the wealthiest, but no one knows for sure how much the family is worth due to years of family secrets.
Yeah.
This is what I mean. It sounds like a conspiracy, but it's not. I don't think it is. Starting in 1743 in Germany, a future coin dealer named Amschel Bauer was born. In 1769, he opened an accounting house and placed a sign on the door depicting a Roman eagle on a red shield.
Okay.
The shop became known as the Red Shield Firm, and in German, Red Shield is Rothschild.
Oh, okay.
So their original last name was Bauer, mm-hmm. and then it turned into Rothschild.
Okay. So they changed their name for the branding.
Mm-hmm. It's for the brand. Yes.
Yeah. A little TM at the back of their name.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Amschel then began lending money and doing banking things. It just evolved into a bank. His son, Mayer Rothschild, when he was old enough, his dad taught him the secret of banking. He taught him about leveraging and multiplying money. Mayer, as he got older, realized that lending to kings and governments was the real way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how he would make a fortune.
Why are you royalty if you need to borrow money? Why isn't the person you're borrowing from the royalty then? Like, that makes no sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that should, if you're not the richest one, why are you in charge?
Yep. Because they're not the richest ones. That's the thing. That's the problem. Yeah. They're not the richest ones. Mayer would then go on to have five sons that would all get into the family business and would help spread the banking empire of the Rothschilds.
He would spread like a virus.
Yeah.
Like a contagion.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And these five sons were spread out throughout Europe in the bigger cities to set up banks in those areas. Mm-hmm. So now we're multi-country in Europe. And they knew by now that encouraging nations to borrow money and incur a national debt would give them power.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Where do you think the mafia got its ideas from?
Yeah, I know.
This is what it, money lending. That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'll give you money, but you have to do stuff for me now. Yep. The borrowing nations would become politically captive by the Rothschilds. If a politician of a nation did something that the family didn't like, they would deny that nation loans, and they would call in any current loans from that nation. Got to pay up now. And then they would lend graciously to the nation's enemies.
Yeah.
Money doesn't care.
Money ain't got no owners, only spenders.
Yeah.
The Wire.
These three banking families would argue that. Mm. They would say, we own it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we own it. The Rothschilds are actually one of the reasons that Napoleon sold the Louisiana territory to the U.S.
Oh.
Yeah. Napoleon wanted to fix France's economy after everything he was doing. And he didn't like the central banking system, meaning a nation borrowing from a, like, I'll explain this more down the line. But he did not like the idea of a central banking system, which is what the Rothschilds were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rothschilds and England were together, right? They they work with the country. And England wanted the colonies back. They were like, this is money.
Like an American, which colonies?
Oh, sorry. The American colonies. Okay. You're right. I forgot.
Okay.
I forgot.
They had a lot of colonies.
I forgot. Sorry. I'm a selfish American, so I only think of me. Mm-hmm. And then I forget that there's a lot. So yes, they wanted the American colonies at back. They were like, we want this. They tried to strike a deal with Napoleon saying, hey, you can take the South and we'll take the industrial North. It'll be great and we'll squeeze more out of them. Napoleon was like, no, because a part of that deal was he had to adopt their bank.
Mm.
And he said, no, I don't want to be in debt to you. I don't want to borrow money from you. I don't want that. I'm trying to get France out of debt. So he sold Louisiana to help France get out of debt.
Okay. And he had no interest in the American continent.
Not that I read. I didn't look too far into it, but he didn't.
What he was.
Yeah. He didn't seem to care too much. Yeah. At this point, he was caring about France and the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The Rothschilds and England were not happy with this because Napoleon just did whatever the fuck he wanted.
Yeah.
And they were like, uh-uh. And a month later, England declared war on France.
Mm. Okay.
So, yeah. I just like to show the influence of this one family so far. All right. So I've said central banking. We're not really sure what that is. I'm still not super sure, but I think I understand it. I'm going to do my best to explain it.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to go way back to when goldsmiths were the first bankers in England, like the 1600s.
Okay.
They would have secure vaults to store gold. And they would hold people's gold, like, hey, we'll hold it for you safely, and we'll write you a receipt for your gold.
It's always absurd to me that we as an entire species have agreed that gold is valuable because what, Sumerians and Egyptians just decided, ooh, ooh, and we just stuck with it. And no one, like, it doesn't actually, it's not really, we just decided it's valuable because we think it is. Yeah. And every society since has been like, yep, let's just follow the lead of the Egyptians on that. Mm-hmm. Why? Anyway,
I can't side say note. Why it began. I mean, I'm assuming because it was rare. So they were like, this is cool. It's rare. We want it. Whatever. I don't care about that. I don't want to get focused that far back. We're already in the 1600s. Yeah. So let's stay on track here. Okay. We have to hone in. But they did try. This is the journey of them trying to not care about gold. Like before this, there were tally sticks. And tally sticks were literal long mm-hmm. sticks that you tallied every time you paid a tax. You paid a property tax or some type of a tax. And then they would split that down the middle lengthwise. And a receipt essentially would be given to like the king. And then you would keep another one. And that was a better way to decide how much money you had because it was based on property.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense. Property is more valuable than gold, really.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the goldsmiths. So in the 1600s, they had gold. They would store it for everyone because they not everyone had a place to keep their gold. And they would give receipts. I think it was like one receipt per ounce of gold. So mm-hmm. you'd have like multiple receipts for however many ounces. Eventually, people began trading their receipts as payment instead of going to the vault, getting their gold and giving it to someone. They used their receipts. And then the goldsmiths realized that only about 10%, about 10% of the depositors wanted their gold back at any one time. So there's never a moment where everyone wants all the gold at once. So only about 10% will withdraw it at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured that they could lie. They could print, 10 receipts for 10 ounces of gold for someone. But then they could also lend out extra receipts to people that don't actually have a gold backing.
Okay.
Because there's gold in their vault, but let's say you have 20 ounces of gold. I give you 20 receipts for it. It's the exact amount.
Okay.
And then someone else comes in and they said, I need money. I need gold to do something. Will you loan me some gold? They go, oh my gosh, yeah, I can. Because let's say you took out 10 ounces of your gold after putting in 20.
Okay.
And then they're like, well, Cole already took some stuff out. We have his extra gold. We'll just use this gold to give to this guy in hopes that Cole doesn't come back trying to collect the rest of his gold.
Okay.
It's a little bit of a risk they're taking. But because they have multiple depositors, it doesn't really, it's not too risky.
Yeah.
We're all on the same page. Okay. I know this might get a little boring, but I promise it's worth it. I promise it's worth it. Okay.
Okay.
I just needed to explain that. So numbers
and amounts are not my forte.
I know.
So I just kind of, yeah.
So basically everyone's depositing gold and then someone can come in and say, I don't have any gold, but I need to buy this farm. Will you lend me money? That banker, that goldsmith is lending out your money to that person. That's all you have to know.
Okay.
So if everyone comes back to collect their gold all at once and this lender has been giving out money, he doesn't have all your money. He fucked up. So depression. And that's still how it's done today, basically. We give money to the bank. The bank will then loan money elsewhere. If you're a millennial, you remember all the student loan things happening. I forgot the names of those lenders. But it was like 2008, 2009, 2010, somewhere in that range where they went bankrupt because they lent out too much. Mm. Banks were lending out too much. It was too much and no one was able to pay it back.
Oh, okay.
So then they had to go bankrupt. But then the government bailed them out, blah, 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 whatever. But yeah, so that's how depressions happen. Eventually, the goldsmiths all banded together and they would control the economy, essentially.
Yeah.
They would say, we can choose to not lend out money. Or we can choose to lend out a lot of money. Or we can call in the loans and make everyone pay us back. Mm-hmm. We can just play this game with the economy. And by the mid to late 1700s, the Bank of England, which was founded in 1694 or whatever, it was pretty greedy already, even though it was only founded like not that long before. Yeah. And they wanted to squeeze as much out of the American colonies as they could, which then led to the American Revolution.
Greed has no ceiling and stupidity no bottom.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Americans, well, Americans did not want a central banking system. They felt it had too much control because they're against kings and one central power at this time. They're really high on that. Today, we love it. But, you know, back then we didn't. And they didn't think that one thing should control all of the money. They're like, this doesn't make fucking sense. Like,
and now we just want daddy to take care of everything.
Yep.
Just put it all, give it all to daddy.
The Americans preferred independent state banks at this time that were not controlled by a central bank.
I know the U.S. didn't even have a unified currency until like 1863.
Yeah.
Like during the Civil War.
Act of 1863.
Like individual banks just issued their own currency all over the country. Yeah. And like your money from a bank in Massachusetts might not be exchangeable to a store in Illinois.
Yeah. Which was an issue with the state banks. Yeah. And that's why the central banking system was trying to come in and take over. But Americans were like, no, 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 we don't want that though. Mm-hmm. We want something like in the middle. Let's figure this out without a debt needing to be incurred in order to use the bank. I just wanted to highlight a few of the American leaders of the time that were fighting against this, that spoke out against it. In 1815, Thomas Jefferson expressed his views on central banking, and he wrote to President Monroe, he said, "The dominion of the banks must be broken or it will break us." There was another gentleman named William Jennings Bryant who ran for president three times but never made it. He was very against just one big bank. He said, "The bankers tell us that this issue of money is a function of the bank and that the government ought to go out of the banking business. I stand with Jefferson rather than with them and say that the issue of money is a function of the government and that the bank should go out of the governing business."
Yes.
So the bankers are like, hey, let the experts handle this. We're the experts. You don't have to let the government get worried about this. Mm-hmm. And then Jefferson and Bryant are like, no, well, I think we do need government oversight. Yeah. Hold on now. This isn't, nope. Another interesting one was Andrew Jackson.
Old Hickory.
Yeah, he was against the central banking system.
He was against minorities existing too.
Yeah, a broken clock is right.
A broken clock finds a mushroom every now and then.
What does that mean?
It's combining two adages, like a blind pig finds an acorn or finds a mushroom, finds a moral.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've never heard
that one. It's
the
same principle.
One.
Like, okay. Yeah.
Okay. I've never heard that one.
Just combining the two.
Never heard it. But yes, so President Andrew Jackson, in his inaugural address, he said, "I have no hesitation to say if they can recharter the bank with this hydra of corruption, they will rule the nation, and its charter will be perpetual and its corrupting influence destroy the liberty of our country. When I came into this administration, I had a majority of 75. Since then, it is now believed the bank has bought votes in Congress." So he's saying, I have less now, and I think the bankers are buying people in the government. Whoa, crazy. Yeah.
It's weird to hear historically people be surprised by things that we just like, that's just how it is.
That's how it's been this whole time.
Yeah.
And now we're just now kind of realizing it, but it's too little too late. In 1835, Jackson was able to pay off the last of the loans that America had incurred when taking out loans through the England, like through the European banks and Rothschilds and things like that. Jackson was the first and only president to ever eliminate the national debt in America.
Oh.
I know. I don't really like that I'm saying good things about this guy. But anyway, he did those things. So interestingly enough, though, I think 3 weeks or so after the announcement of zero national debt, it was soon after that, that an English house painter fired two shots at Jackson. The pistol misfired, but it was the first ever attempt to kill a sitting president.
It was on the steps of the Capitol?
I don't know.
It was in, like, it was like, he like hit him with his walking stick or something.
Oh, that makes sense. Jackson, I don't know,
like,
the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah. He like, Jackson was walking on the steps of some government building. I think it was the Capitol. I don't think it was the White House. Okay. But and this guy came up to him and shot at him, and he, with his walking stick or his cane, just
hit him.
You beat the fuck out of him.
Well, the shooter bragged and said, like, once he was caught, that powerful people from the banking world promised to protect him.
And then he was executed.
Yeah, they just they did not. They lied. Shocking.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know how how true that is. It's interesting the timeline of things though. Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, Jackson did go a little bit too far when fighting against the central bank. He required that all purchases be made with an actual gold or silver backing. You had to have a 1-to-1 ratio. And he introduced silver into the economy mm-hmm. instead of just gold to make it easier. And he didn't want loans. He was like, we're done with it. Just pay. If you have the money, you're going to pay it. And that's how it's going to go.
What's that country in Africa?
I don't know.
Eritrea? Eritrea?
How do you pronounce it?
I think it's Eritrea.
Okay, yes, but, that's a country. Yeah,
but yeah, everything's just cash.
Yeah. No, they don't have banks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah.
so great.
Yeah, if you don't have it on you, you don't buy it. That's it. Yeah.
There's a lot of other things that the country could use,
but
it's, they don't need
banks. I think it's unique in that sense. I think it's the only country in the world, but I don't want to speak to that.
Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah.
Look it up.
Yeah, look it up. Let us know if it's the only country in the world or not. Comment.
Yeah.
So when Jackson did this, it was a little bit too quick to make that hard change, and it caused a financial collapse and the panic of 1837.
Mm.
So, yeah. With Jackson now out of the White House, he was done with his presidency. The bankers made the Depression of 1837 even worse because they wanted everyone to learn a lesson.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Yeah. They were like, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
We're going to really drill it in how shitty what he did was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they withdrew all of their loans from the general public.
Okay.
And they say, pay us back now. And they also said, we will only take it back in gold. We won't use the silver-backed money.
Mm-hmm.
We'll only use the gold-backed money, which that sucks. That's shitty.
Yeah.
What if you have a silver-backed dollar? You can't do anything with it now. And this depression forced the new president, Van Buren, to borrow money.
Number eight.
The okay boys,
The Van B boys.
Oh.
The Van Buren boys.
Oh, yeah. Okay is
fingers.
Also connected to Van Buren. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All correct, okay.
Oh, remember that was during
our episode?
I forgot that was, I forgot it was tied to Van Buren, though.
Yeah, that's why we know okay more.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen to borrowed words. So Van Buren wanted to borrow money from the bankers, but like I said, they were teaching him a lesson. Well, mm-hmm. teaching America a lesson. And U.S. Treasury officials visited James Rothschild in Europe, and they were asking for a loan for the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And he responded, this is a quote, and this is a real quote. I double checked. He said, tell your colleagues that you have seen the man who is at the head of finances in Europe, and that he has told you that they cannot borrow a dollar. Not a dollar. What a dick.
Nice.
So they're teaching America a lesson.
Yeah.
They're like pressing their knees on our neck and saying, you will bend. You will. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to jump to Lincoln, 1862 to 65. President Lincoln.
Yeah.
And he also hates the idea of a central bank. He's fighting it. So then he adds $450 million into the economy, but he calls them U.S. notes. He just prints them. And to distinguish them from the debt owed money, so the ones that are backed with loans, he had the U.S. notes printed with green ink on the back and a red seal on the front, leading people to call them
greenbacks.
Greenbacks. And within 4 days of Congress authorizing greenbacks, bankers met at a convention in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
They had to come up with something to get rid of the greenbacks.
Mm.
They were like, this is not good.
Yeah.
Because this was actually a good thing for the American people. Greenbacks were a little more transferable state to state.
Yeah.
Still not as well, but still could be.
Yeah.
A private letter was sent out to the wealthiest stockholders and the bankers. It was known as the Hazard Circular.
Okay.
And it said that it will not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate as money for any length of time, as we cannot control that. But we can control the bonds, and through them, the bank issues. Bonds or loans,
mm-hmm.
same thing. They just straight up say, we won't have control of the greenbacks, and we want control. That's all I've seen throughout all of this, is these banking families want control, period.
Yeah.
So
we're not deep as a species.
No, we're not.
Greed and control and dominance. That's it.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep. Money is just a means to that.
Yeah.
That's all it is. They don't need the money.
Just freeing yourself from any consequences. That's what the rich ultimately want. Freedom mm-hmm. from any consequence to anything.
Yeah.
And that's mm-hmm. what Musk's and his ilk have attained. Freedom from consequence. Yeah.
All billionaires are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of them.
Yeah.
Every single one. I don't care what they've done to charity. If they haven't, if they've not given enough to take their status down from billionaire, be a 999 millionaire.
Which J.K. Rowling did until she became awful herself. She was like the first person, I think.
To then, like say no to that, basically.
Yeah, she was the first person, I think, who obtained billionaire status and then of her own accord.
Took it away.
Yeah, by her charitable work. But then she became a TERF.
Yeah, you know, it's just another tally for the millennials. It's fine. I've already mourned that. Anyway, so after Lincoln was assassinated, mm-hmm. the bankers were, yeah.
R.I.P.
I know, but I've never heard someone say rip after we talk about Lincoln's assassination. R.I.P.
It's been long enough. We can finally make jokes about it. It's okay now.
It's too soon.
It's too soon.
Want to get high? Maybe not really, really high, but just a little bit. Just take the edge off. With Good Feels, you can do just that. Good Feels is a cannabis seltzer that is perfect for relaxation, enjoyment, or to take that edge off when you have to be around people and don't want to be. I feel that. Good Feels cannabis seltzer is sugar-free and made of high-quality, natural ingredients with flavors like blood orange, grapefruit, and pineapple mango. I finished a six-pack of the pineapple mango and loved it. Not in one sitting. It was throughout the week, of course, but it was very nice to have one after I got home instead of alcohol that's going to make me dehydrated and not feel so good the next day. If you're not into carbonation, no worries. Good Feels has you covered with mood boosters. These are drink enhancements you add to your water, controlling the amount of THC in your drink. I'm currently sipping on water that has been enhanced by the lemonade flavor, and I've got to tell you, it's pretty, pretty nice. I'm feeling relaxed and calm. Go to shop.getgoodfeels.com today and use our promo code BONES, B-O-N-E-S, to get 20% off. That's shop.getgoodfeels.com, promo code BONES. And remember, you got to be 21 to buy it. Shop.getgoodfeels.com, promo code BONES.
Little Bob here. This summer, shop the latest small space solutions at Bob's Discount Furniture. From retro chic bedroom sets to stylish space-conscious Bob-o-pedic sofas, it's all at Bob's, where America shops for furniture.
So after he was assassinated, the bankers were back at it and they bought more politicians and convinced Congress to like slow down or pull back on the greenbacks. Mm-hmm. They're still out there, but not as much. So these bankers are like inching slowly. And this has been years, right? It started in the 1700s.
Centuries.
Yeah. Well, at this point, it's been almost it's been a century at this point. Yeah. Yeah. So now the London banks were selling U.S. government bonds because we needed it, and we got more and more in debt to London, to England.
Yeah.
The London-based chief financial agent selling the U.S. bonds was named Junius Spencer Morgan, the founder of J.S. Morgan and Company.
J.P. sounds better than J.S. Is that why he changed it?
He's a different guy.
Oh.
He's an American. But he's in England doing banking, like he's a part of the banking world. His son, John Pierpont Morgan.
Oh, yeah, Pierpont.
Better known as J.P. Morgan today, but back then he went by Pierpont. Mm-hmm. His dad, Junius, taught him the family business. So that's where we get J.P. Morgan. Yeah.
I don't trust adults who go by initials.
He didn't. He went by Pierpont.
Okay.
We...
I would go by JP if
it was. Exactly. I think Pierpont is worse.
Horrible
name.
Yeah. Sorry to all the Pierponts out there, but you probably know it already.
I've never seen this name before, but it's Pierpont. And so, yes, I'm going to call him JP, though, because that's how we all know him best. Because he does end up taking over for his dad and renaming it JP Morgan and Company. Mm-hmm. But it started as JS.
Okay.
JP was a dick. He got super rich during the Civil War. He bought
War profiteering.
Yes.
Lovely.
Yes. Yes. He bought firearms for the Union Army. He purchased them himself at 50 cents each. Today, that's $16 roughly.
Okay.
Then he sold them to the Union for $22 each. Mm. That's about $660 today.
Okay.
When the draft came, he was one of the ones that paid the $300 to have someone go in his stead. And the $300 back then was about $9,800 today. The company during the Civil War rose from $30,000 to $58,000 in just 1 year from him war profiteering.
Mm-hmm.
The $30,000 today is $989,000. The $58,000 today is $1.5 million.
Hmm.
So he grew very quickly profiting off of war.
Yeah. Although he could say he profited off his desire to end slavery.
If you wanted to end it, he would give it away for free.
That's true. Yeah.
Give it away for free.
Yeah, give away. Yeah. If you're for the cause itself.
If you're for the cause, you'll just do it.
Yeah.
Especially because you didn't need the money.
Yeah.
When you don't need the money and you do things for a cause, but you still require money, fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck off. Like, do it because you're nice.
Yeah.
But you're not a billionaire if you're nice. So it all goes hand in hand. Anyway, with all this money, J.P. Morgan and one of his friends, Edward Ketchum, they quietly bought up a lot of gold. They were scheming.
Mm-hmm.
And then they dumped over $1 million of gold onto the London market. And then this created a gold shortage in New York, where J.P. Morgan was based. And now Morgan and Ketchum were in a great position to sell the gold that they stored away to New York, to America. And they each profited like $60,000. So, yeah, again, another like over $1 million for them each. JP's dad, Junius, he was a very proud American and enjoyed American ideals and values. And he was just in London holding down the London branch of his company. And this is what JP was doing back in America. It made his dad really mad. He threatened JP to sever all business ties due to his greed.
I'm confused. He's upset that his son is...
being a dick.
Oh.
Being super greedy. He's upset that his son created this problem.
Oh, okay.
And then is benefiting from it.
Okay. But JS was also a banker, right?
Yeah, but not this bad.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. JP's more.
I didn't think he'd be greedier than me.
Yeah. Right.
What the fuck?
Right.
I learned it from watching you, Dad. Like, what the... I thought your greed would stop where mine did.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yep. But of course, his dad never did cut ties.
Yeah, of course. What's he going to do?
Like, okay. He's like, you're a bad kid. That's it. Yeah.
Fuck you, pay me.
Yeah. So also in 1863, you already touched on this earlier, Congress passed the National Bank Act, which allowed for the first time a system of federally chartered banks.
Okay.
So now they're not using the central banking system from like Europe. They're they're implementing America, starting to do an American thing.
This was in the midst of the American Civil War.
Yeah.
Like right in the middle of it. So that was a factor into it too.
Which is on purpose. Mm-hmm. Chaos is their friend.
Yeah.
They do well when we're not paying attention. Hey, they knew this way back then. We know it today. So anyway, now they're starting to have a little more control. There's still state banks. There are still greenbacks, but now federally chartered banks are in. And this led to the creation of the First National Bank, the Second National Bank, the Third. You see all those everywhere. That's why they are that way.
Okay.
It's the First National, Second National, Third, because no one's creative back then.
Yeah.
So that's why we have all those. And because of this, just 2 years after the Civil War, there were four times as many federally charted or debt-backed banknotes in the circulation, like money, four times as many banknotes as there were greenbacks in the system.
Okay.
Lincoln, Secretary of Treasury at this time, he actually helped push this act through, thinking it was a good thing. But then when he realized what was going on, he regretted it. And he said, "My agency in promoting the passage of the National Banking Act was the greatest financial mistake in my life."
That was Lincoln saying that?
No, his Treasury.
Oh, Treasury.
Like Secretary. One of his people.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It has built up a monopoly that affects every interest in the country. It should be repealed. But before that can be accomplished, the people will be arrayed on one side and the banks on the other in a contest such as we have never seen in this country.
This is during the Civil War, he's saying this.
2 years after.
2 years. We've never seen war. Like, what will happen?
He's saying it's going to be the banks against the people. Yeah, and yeah. We've never seen that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's a little prophecy kind of if you think about it. Okay. Now we're jumping to 1866. This is kind of boring. Congress passed another act that took greenbacks out of circulation. So now greenbacks are gone because the bankers are still gaining more power. In 1873, another act was passed, again, backed by the bankers, pushed by them, that making banknotes only backed by gold now and not silver, because that was still something that within the American economy you could use, which then made things even tighter because, like we said, if you have to pay back, like half your money is gone now. However, at this time, independent banks were still around, and we jump a little bit further in 1878, Congress didn't like repeal anything, but they said, no, we can bring silver back. We can still do greenbacks. Like, it was this back and forth for like a chunk of time in America. Mm-hmm. So the American people were getting tired. They were like, can we do this? Can we do that? Can we do this? Can we do that? It was a lot of back and forth, very confusing to me. So that's the best way I can explain it. Mm-hmm. Of course, bankers wanted all of the control. So in 1891, a memo was sent out by the American Banking Association, or ABA, and it called for bankers to cause a depression on a certain date 3 years into the future in 1894.
Okay.
The memo said, on September 1st, 1894, we will not renew our loans under any consideration. On September 1st, we will demand our money. We will foreclose and become mortgagees in possession. We can take 2/3 of the farms west of the Mississippi and thousands of them east of the Mississippi as well, at our own price. Then the farmers will become tenants as in England. Is that fucked?
Yep.
They planned a Great Depression. Or a depression.
Mm-hmm. People are scum.
Yeah. Closer to the 1894 deadline, another memo was sent out, but it was public and like printed in newspapers.
Okay.
So March 11th, 1894, it was called the Panic Circular. The memo urged all national banks to take all the silver dollars and silver certificates as well as greenbacks out of circulation. It's like demanding a finality to them. No more back and forth. They wanted that gold-only money system forever. Loans were called in. A ton of money was taken out of circulation, causing the panic of 1894. European investors were also calling for their money to come back, which, of course, caused even more of a depression. And JP wrote a letter to his brother in regards to the gold-only, like, system. He wrote, "As a man of sense, I am a gold bug and support a gold bug government and a gold bug society. As a man of the world, I like confusion, anarchy, and war."
Yeah. Lovely. Was it anarchy, confusion?
Anarchy, and war.
Some men just like to watch the world burn.
Yeah, I think he's one of them. You get so much money, you get bored, right? Mm-hmm. We're watching it in front of our very eyes with all these billionaires.
Yeah.
You get bored and you just, what do? Build buildings in China. Yeah. I don't know. So JP had a plan because he still needed to win over the public opinion on central banks. That's what's really holding them back, because people were rioting at certain points. People were getting violent during certain points. Like, there was a lot of chaos surrounding banks in America in the early years. And he was like, okay, we're not winning. We really need to figure out how to win them over. So he and the Rothschilds financed the newspaper, the Chattanooga Times. And this owner was a lover of gold. He aligned with them. And Morgan and Rothschild gave him enough money to buy the New York Times.
Oh.
And he did purchase the New York Times. So I don't know.
Who is this?
His name is, or was, Adolf Ox. I didn't look up his last name, how to pronounce it. O-C-H-S.
Yeah, Ox, yeah. I guess.
I don't know too much about him, but he did write some, you know, favorable articles in there. So they had the New York Times in their pocket. That can help them win public favor. President McKinley was strongly backed by J.P. Morgan.
Not for long.
And after his terms as president, America was forever on the gold standard.
He was assassinated. That's why I made that joke.
I know. I'm going to talk about it. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. However, the big three banking families just still were not satisfied after McKinley put in this gold only standard. There were still some independent banks out there. Mm-hmm. And they wanted all of the banks under one central control. However, when McKinley was assassinated, that fucked it all up again. Mm-hmm. Because who took over?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes. Do you know what?
Trust Buster.
The trust bustin'
bust
fiend.
This.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't really said the word trust too much, but trust is just another word for monopoly.
Yeah.
That's it. So he was known as the trust buster. He hated monopolies, didn't want them. Clearly the banks were trying to become that. Mm-hmm. And Teddy Roosevelt was like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But really pissed off the bankers again.
He wouldn't do well as a Republican today.
No, no. He enjoyed animals and forests and people and roads and helping and creating.
He's a conservationist.
Yes. And, yeah. So by 1907, JP and his buddies were just pissed. They decided to create the Panic of 1907.
Mm-hmm.
They attacked J.P. Morgan's Wall Street rival, the Hines Morse Group. They were holders of banking, mining, steel, and shipping interests, so they were a rival. The bankers manipulated the market. William Rockefeller, he spread rumors that the Hines copper interests were in trouble and that their banks were not doing well. Mm-hmm. They were like, uh-oh, these banks aren't doing great. And under the Hines Morse Group, under that umbrella, there was a bank, the Knickerbocker Trust Company.
Okay.
JP wanted to target that specifically. He knew that this would be the easiest one to knock off, basically. He was like, this is the easiest one to kill. The Knickerbocker Trust Company was one of the largest financial institutions in the early 20th century. JP helped take it down. And after the rumors were out, people panicked and ran to the Knickerbocker Bank to withdraw all of their money.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, as we've learned, if everyone at once withdraws all of their money from a bank who's lending and loaning?
Depression.
Yes, they don't have enough in their bank because they've lent your money out to someone else, hoping that you're not going to call it in. And so within a few days, the bank was forced to close.
Mm-hmm.
The fear spread to other Hines Group banks and then to the whole banking world. It just spread like wildfire. And a lot of people went to collect their money. Banks didn't have it. Mm-hmm. Hence the panic of 1907. J.P. Morgan even called in loans. He was like, yeah, I'll call mine in too.
Yeah.
And he refused to give out new ones. And at this time, thousands of banks in America closed. And at this point, the American public were just tired. Now JP knew that the public was looking for a savior because they didn't know like who started the rumors. They just knew rumors were afoot and they listened and panicked, right?
Yeah.
So now the American public, they just want reliable, safe banking. My God, like what can we do? And JP was like, I can be a savior here.
Oh, so he becomes a malignant hero, the guy that causes the problem, saves it. Yeah, kind of like Jesus.
Yeah. Okay.
He died to save us from what he would do to us if he didn't. Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Malignant hero.
Anyway, JP offered to save the very last Hines Bank, but only if the Morse Group, the Hines Morse Group, would sell him their Tennessee Coal and Iron Company for a fraction of its value. They had to agree. They were forced into it, and JP ended up putting $200 million of his own money into circulation. It wasn't really his money, though. He just printed money that wasn't backed by gold at all and just threw it back into circulation to be like, oh, my God, I helped. Hey, guys, look at me.
Mm-hmm.
It did help. It stimulated the economy. And by 1908, the panic was over and J.P. Morgan was viewed as a hero.
Mm.
Little fucker.
Yeah.
Also in 1908, the legislative lead on banking reform was taken over by Senator Nelson Aldrich. He was the head of the Senate Finance Committee, and he was also the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller Jr.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter married him.
Jekyll.
Yep.
For his stunning personality, I'm sure.
Yeah. Aldrich was also friends with J.P. Morgan. And Aldrich would help establish a National Monetary Commission, also known as NMC.
Okay.
Now, this commission would suggest proposals for banking reform, pushing for a centralized banking system. He said we needed to take politics out of finances and leave it to the experts. Pushing that rhetoric again.
Mm-hmm.
At J.P. Morgan's suggestion, Aldrich appointed J.P. Morgan's business partner, Henry Davison, as his top advisor. Aldrich also chose, I don't think he really had a choice, another...
No one does.
Yeah. Aldrich chose another J.P. Morgan man. His name is Abram Andrew, and he was an economics professor. Then Aldrich hired a man named Charles Conant, C-O-N-A-N-T, for research and public relations for the NMC. Then he included two other men, Warburg and Vanderlip. We'll later on learn why these people matter.
Okay.
So all of these gentlemen began really ramping up PR for Central Bank in 1909. J.P. Morgan's friend, who was a Chicago banker, delivered a presidential address to the American Bankers Association plugging for a central bank. Then, in September of 1909, President Taft spoke in Boston and suggested that the country consider a national bank. Him and Aldrich were also friendly. September of 1909, or later that month, in 1909, the Wall Street Journal began a 14-part front page series of editorials entitled A Central Bank of Issue, and that was written by Charles Conant.
Okay.
And as we just learned, he's paid by the NMC.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he's going to lean a little bit that way. Now, Warburg was also out stumping for a national bank. And when he promoted it, he was very careful to say that it would not be run by stockholders or Wall Street or any sort of monopoly style thing. He lied.
Yeah.
But he made sure he knew what the public wanted to hear. He pushed for government officials to appoint experts in their fields to oversee central banking. So again, government out and experts in. And he expressed that bankers should make up most of this group.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Warburg had a famous speech that he delivered in New York in 1910. This speech was printed, 30,000 copies of it was printed, and it was distributed everywhere that spring. And then that same spring, there were numerous research volumes on various aspects of banking that were just pushed into the public, pushed in, like, hey, look at all these things we're learning about central banking, everything. With all of this information just being thrown at the masses, the object was to overload the public with information, flood the zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's much like we see today when the government wants to do something that they know the public won't really like. They sort of lie and they push those lies at us. And eventually we just are like gaslit into believing that that's the way to go.
They barely even try anymore. I mean, like in the last, just like,
They were more clever back then.
Yeah. Fuck you, I'm doing it. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck you for asking why I'm doing it. Yeah.
So the public at this point was starting to bend. They were like, fine. It's like the latter half of 1910. Again, they're getting tired, but the bankers still needed to like bring it home, right? Okay, how do we cinch this? And there was a big conference with all the bigwig bankers, monetary businessmen, everyone was there. And at this conference, they spoke about how to push it. And they were like, Senator Aldrich needs to write a bill. He needs to present a bill to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to figure out how to write this bill.
So, ChatGPT. They didn't have that to write it for them?
I guess no. But, you know, they needed to iron out the details.
Mm.
But what's everyone going to agree with? Right.
Yeah.
We all know we need this goal, but how do we get there?
Mm-hmm.
It's said that Henry Davison, but really it was JP, because Henry Davison is JP's guy, had this idea to get a small group of the top leaders together, super secret, to draft the bill. And JP arranged for a private conference at his exclusive millionaire retreat, the Jekyll Island Club. Remember, JP was co-owner of this club as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he facilitates all of this. He doesn't go, but he facilitates it all. November 22nd, 1910, Aldrich and his crew went in a privately owned chartered railroad car from New Jersey to coastal Georgia under the guise of a duck hunting trip. Only six people were allowed to attend this super secret meeting, and those six people reflected the power structure.
Mm-hmm.
We have Aldrich, who's in Morgan's pocket and the government's pocket, the Rockefellers. And he's connected to the Rockefellers. I keep forgetting about that because of his son-in-law. Then we have Henry Davison, who is a partner of J.P. Morgan's. Then we have Paul Warburg, who is a partner of Kuhn and Loeb, which we don't really need to get into them, but if you're in the market, that's still a name that's recognizable today. Mm. So that's another big company there. We have Frank Vanderlip, who is the vice president of Rockefeller's National City Bank in New York. We have Charles Norton, who is the president of J.P. Morgan's First National Bank in New York. So not the Citibank, but another one. And then we have Abram Andrew, who is the head of the NMC research staff, and he was recently made Secretary of Treasury under Taft.
Mm-hmm.
He also had interests with Rockefeller and Morgan's businesses. There were a few other men that may or may not have been there because it was so secret. I don't know exactly all the names, but these are the ones that are the most likely, the ones that we do know were there. So there's a few other ones that might pop up if you do your own research. I don't really know exactly. This is where the tinfoil hat kind of comes into play. These men meet on Jekyll Island for a week and have this secret meeting. And this is where the Aldrich Bill is forged. And this bill would result in the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And this is also the reason that the Great Depression was so bad. But we will get into all of those details.
It's like a preamble, too.
For part two.
Yes. I'd hate to be the cleaning lady who went to that Jekyll Island after they were done.
Yeah, yeah. It was
probably
like a week.
Like a Jackson Pollock painting in there.
Yeah, they were there for like a week, maybe 10 days, but yeah, like a week. And this is, yeah, super secret. We don't know exactly what they did, but they went dug.
Connive hard, bang hard.
Yeah. That is the background. We needed to know all of that to understand why this meeting matters, why these three big banking companies can just suck a dick. I don't know what else to say. It really sucks. We were forced into this, and here we are. But yes, for part two, it'll be less money, 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 and more of what happened on Jekyll Island, what went on, and the aftermath of it all, because Americans did see what happened after it did. They realized once they were punked, I guess, they realized it after the fact, a little too late, but they were mad. And there were some... They went after them. They went after these guys.
Not well enough, apparently, because we're still...
Nope, not well enough.
I mean...
Nope. Nope.
Spoiler, they lost.
Yeah, we lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bombs lose.
Yes, yes. So there's definitely going to be a part two. I just could not fit all of this into one part, and I hope that it made sense. Haha, no pun intended. Yeah. But yes, I hope it all made sense. I hope it wasn't too boring for everyone. To me, this was very interesting, and I think it... helps me understand the economic system that we're in today, especially because we just went through a big house purchase. And I was like, why do we have to do all this? What is this? And interest was also a part of all of this. Of course, that's how they made their money. When they lent money out, they charge, 2% interest, 3%, 4%. They're lending your money out and making money off of it. Mm-hmm. When you're the one taking that
your
risk.
Your fellow man
truly.
Is always out to hurt you, never out to help you.
Yeah, you don't.
That's the rule of thumb everyone should know. If you teach your kid one lesson, it's everyone around them is out to hurt them.
Yeah.
Even if they pretend they're out to help them, it's to line their own pockets in the end. The more you know.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Little Bob here. This summer, shop the latest small space solutions at Bob's Discount Furniture. From retro chic bedroom sets to stylish space-conscious Bob-o-pedic sofas, it's all at Bob's, where America shops for furniture.